Well, this is Bing Gong. I'm co-host of the Post Carbon Radio program that's on the second and fourth Mondays of the month. But this last weekend, I attended a two-day teach-in in New York City entitled Techno-Utopianism and the Fate of the Earth, Why Technology Will Not Save the World. It took place last weekend, October 25th and 26th, at the Great Hall of the Cooper Union, and it featured over 50 speakers, workshops, and it was an incredible experience. There were there were 22 hours of panels and discussions, and each panel was on a different aspect of this techno-utopianism, and it was presented by the International Forum on Globalization and the Techno-Utopia Project in collaboration with the International Center for Technological Assessment, the New York Open Center, and the Schumacher Center for New Economics. Let me just read a little bit from the program here. 45-plus leading scholars, authors, and activists will convene at the Great Hall of the Cooper Union, New York City, for a public teach-in on the profound impacts, environmental, economic, and social, of runaway technological expansionism and cyber immersion, the tendency to see technology as the savior of all problems. A change of direction is required, returning the fate of nature to the center of economic and social decision making. And it was an amazing gathering of thought leaders, over 50 speakers from many diverse fields, critiquing technology, our current mindset, and our separation from nature. We are so immersed in technological change, we rarely stop or slow down to contemplate its impact on us and question if we are better off today with our cell phones, computers, GMOs, etc. The teach-in looked at new emerging technologies, nanotechnology, synthetic biology, geoengineering, drones, and others. And I was able to audio tape most of the teach-in and will eventually archive the material West Marin Commons Post Carbon website. That's wmpostcarbon.com. You can go there and I will be posting this material up of many of the speakers that spoke at the two-day teach-in. And you could also go to the International Forum on Globalization's website, that's ifg.org, to view the program and the speakers and get an idea of what the teach-in was all about. Today I've picked out three speakers to present air. Jerry Mander, who with speak about questions we should have asked about technology, Doug Tompkins, Technology and Nature, Clash of Concepts, and John Michael Greer, author of The Wealth of Nature, False Promises. There were also many women presenting, and next week, I will be presenting some more material on Wednesday, November 5th at 12 noon. And that's also Pledge Week. So after this program, I was thinking about throwing my cell phone away. But seriously, we're so addicted to our new technology that it would really be hard to do. But I'm looking at technology in new ways. So it was a very transformative experience for me. And so I hope you will listen in, and if you have any questions, give me a call, and I will try to present as much material as I can, given the time that I am available. So here is Jerry Mander, founder of the International Forum on Globalization and the main organizer of the event. And he is introduced by Ralph King of the New York Open Center.
It was such a crucial issue, and an issue that flies under the radar with our generalized perception of self-absorption and elevation of all things.
So I have, I guess, two.
Technological, to being a valuable and indisputable future for humanity. This is a contrary voice asking the right questions. And there's nobody better to serve at the center of that conversation, to sound that dissident voice, to pose the necessary questions, than Jerry Mander, who has really been at the heart of this work for a long time, dating all the way back to his book. Caring for the heart and soul of these events. I mean, just the way he pours himself into creating these phenomenal teachings with the unique style that bring people in literally from all over the world. It's a truly unique and brilliant contribution. So many of you know Jerry already, so I'll just say a few words of introduction, but he is the author of many books, starting with the Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television back in the 1970s. That was a real take on techno-utopianism. And he's In the Absence of the Sacred, on the failure of technology and the survival of Indian nations. There have been quite a number of other books since. Most recently is the Capitalism Papers, on the critique of capitalism as a system that's in its declining phase. Paradigm Wars, co-sponsored, The Case Against the Global Economy and for the Local Economy, and others. So Jerry has been a brilliant critic of rampant globalization and of an unthinking embrace of technology. He's a founder and was for many years executive director of the International Forum on Globalization, where he now serves as a distinguished fellow. And he's project director for the Techno-Utopianism and Globalization Project of the Foundation for Deep Ecology. I say, by the way, it's a truly historic spot. This is where Abraham Lincoln clinched his nomination. So it's a place that exudes history, and it's a very appropriate place to be doing an event like this, which I think is of a historic clarity and a great bringing together of a lot of the clear-sighted minds. So it's my welcome, my great pleasure, I should say, to really welcome the man of the heart of this event. He's done so much with his team to pull this together. He's really one of the most courageous and clear-sighted and penetrating thinkers and writers that we have on this great subject of technology and globalization. So let's give a warm welcome to Jerry Mander.
Thank you so much, Ralph, for that embarrassing introduction. It's great to be here. Thanks so much for coming to this teach-in. Maybe we should really call it a marathon. Rather than a teach-in, there's going to be 50 speakers over 22 hours on 2 days in a steady stream, covering as many nuances and aspects of this question as we can manage to fit. And very few breaks, you might have noticed, in the schedule. I do believe this meeting is extremely urgent, given the state of the climate and of the skies, the state of the oceans, which are rapidly acidifying, corals disappearing, sea life disappearing, and now the news of the imminent sixth great extinction, the expected loss of 30-50% of all wildlife species on Earth by mid-century. This is not to mention disappearing fresh water, disappearing fertile lands, forests, food supply, and much more we will be reporting. This is definitely one of the greatest moments in history right now, and we're here to explore the role of technology in making this happen, and our attitude and acquiescences that have contributed to it. Producing this event has actually not been easy. We live in a techno-dazzled world, and there's considerable resistance to the very idea of challenging technology. In fact, as we were planning this event, I got a call from a very well-known reporter at the New York Times, a very friendly, supportive guy who has written beautifully about our anti-globalization events in the past. He said he found the event very exciting, but he also said the program seemed too biased against technology. When were we going to invite the other side? I had to tell him, no, we weren't. I mean, as we proceed, some of us may express appreciation for some obvious benefits. I mean, I wrote about this conference on a very old, decrepit, 10-year-old laptop. It still gets the job done. That's good. But before that, I wrote some books with an Underwood manual typewriter, including some of my better ones, I might add. It was slow, but slow is good. Ideas pop up instead of ads and email blips and texts. And let's see, I flew here on an airplane and took a taxi from the airport, and I'm talking into a microphone. There are lights in the room. Even I use some technology, okay? How could I not? But that is not the point. The point is to get clear on the systemic totality of impacts from all of it before it's too late. The pluses and the minuses. Besides flying you to New York, what else have airplanes brought us? Besides taxis from the airport, what else have automobiles brought? Pavement covering the world. Massive nonstop oil development, resource depletion, not to mention climate change. And now we have computers. They tie the world together. They accelerate communication. They make corporate globalization more likely and more effective. And they accelerate its negative impacts. They also separate us from ourselves and reduce real communications to tweets. Another writer calls it digital nowhere. And Sherry Turkle, of whom I'm a great fan, try to get her to come, calls it alone together. But we'll get more into that as we go. I argued with my friend from the Times. I pointed out the fact that nearly all information we get from about technology comes from the people who invent, promote, and sell it. We don't really need to hear from them at this event. We hear from them every day on TV and on the internet. We've been hearing from them for years. U.S. corporations now spend about $200 billion a year in advertising, telling us what to think about things and to say what's great about their products and services. I doubt many people in this room spent even $1 billion to counter these messages, or much more than the $50 it probably cost you to get in here. Monsanto Corporation, for example, doesn't really need to be here to respond to our panel a little bit later on genetics, later today, to tell us what's so great about GMOs. Over the last 3 years, Monsanto has already spent $402 million arguing that GMOs are wonderful. Dow Chemical and Union Carbide spent similar amounts. General Electric doesn't really need to tell us about clean, safe nuclear energy. We've heard that. And we don't need Eric Schmidt to tell us about computers, driverless cars, and Google Glass. We get it. We want to discuss the rest of the story. What else do they bring? How do they unify our minds within a certain worldview? How do they envelop us within their frameworks? What are their hidden harms to the planet? And how do we deal with the staggering information imbalance that exists right now in our country on these questions? So, okay, let's get started. I'm already running out of time. We have 50 speakers this weekend, and we're each of us allowed only 15 to 20 minutes. You're going to hear gongs go off when we proceed after 15 minutes. And I've already used at least 5. Where to begin? Should we start with agriculture 5,000 years ago? How about monotheism? Or the Enlightenment 300 years ago? Maybe we should. They're all relevant. But I think I'm going to start in 1936, the year of my birth. In the midst of the Great Depression, and just as World War II was getting underway. Hopefully, it will lead us to a list of good questions we should have asked about technology before this global mess ever got underway. In 1936, there was still practically no commercial plane travel of the sort I just took. Jet airplanes were non-existent. There were no space satellites, no microwave ovens, no faxes or copy machines, no tape recorders. There were no stereo music systems in 1936. There was no television. There was no plastic in 1936. No plastic. There was no air conditioning, nor were there freeways, shopping malls. There were no suburbs, as we came to know them after Lebanon was destroyed. There was no telephone touch dialing, no birth control pills, no Viagra. There were no credit cards. There were no pesticides or herbicides, no computers, no tweeting or texting, no nuclear weapons in space. That was 78 years ago. During my lifetime, all that has changed. 4 years later, in 1940, my family took me to the Great New York World's Fair. More than any prior event, the New York World's Fair set out to create a techno-utopian, highly romantic vision that set the dominant expectations of the post-World War II, 1940s and 1950s. More than 45 million people visited the New York World's Fair during its two-year tenure. That was over one-third of the country's population. It was a fabulous event. I remember it vividly. More than any prior event, it emblazoned in the public mind a new set of expectations for technology rising up over the horizon. The possibility that there could be negative effects on the planet or on human society and welfare from any of the above was never, ever mentioned. And we didn't know to ask. The exhibits were produced by the biggest corporations of the day. I saw seven-tiered techno cities, monorails transporting people at 300 miles per hour, drone-like things whirling between 500-story buildings, humans flying with little rocket packs on their backs, while robots at street level walked the dogs. Ronald Reagan was speaking out as the voice of General Electric, and the DuPont exhibit offered their slogan, "Better things for better living through chemistry." The cities of 20 years hence, that would have been 1960, had eliminated all slums, were filled with parks featuring controlled climate, always a good day, controlled climate. There were happy Americans living in domed environments on other planets. Another exhibit showed how with modern air conditioning, we'd soon be living underground. Another exhibit predicted the conquering of all disease, the extension of our lifespan to hundreds of years, the elimination of insects by pesticides, and the total end of poverty. 45 million people experienced what was essentially an advertisement for a future techno-paradise that we would all love. Wouldn't everyone want a fully automated household and voice-activated shopping? Doesn't everyone love cute little robots? New technology would bring happiness, prosperity, peace, the American dream, never before so passionately sold. As a child of those times, I found the images thrilling. They became a mental blueprint that I carried into the future in common with most of my generation. That the vision was merely a corporate representation of the future never occurred to people. That there might be downside problems for some of these visions was never explored. That it could have deleterious effects on nature never mentioned. It was a one-sided story meant to promote corporate profits and ferocious economic growth. Where was the other side? Another key moment came as World War II was ending. The U.S. economy had saved itself from the Great Depression, a massive wartime buildup, military production, and employment. But with the war nearly over, and the troops coming home, and the factories still building tanks and jeeps and bombs, what next? In the 1950s came a new focus on consumer products, much of it rooted in war-related technical advances. Cheaper, faster air travel, chemicals, pharmaceuticals, and pesticides for home use, washing machines, refrigerators, hi-fis, fancy cars, as well as radars and sonars. And two other dramatic new technologies suddenly appeared. One was computers, though still at that point for military and industrial use for the most part. But maybe most important of all, television. TV had actually been invented decades before, but suddenly had a higher purpose. TV could merge with advertising to lead the transformation of American society into a consumerist society. Yeah. Television became the greatest delivery system for advertising ever invented, and it still is. Between 1945 and 2013, U.S. corporations spent $500 trillion in advertising, by far most of it in television, all celebrating the same worldview via different products. Over the last 50 years, including right now, the average American watched television for 4.5 hours per day. Those are the statistics for right now, too. That means half the population watches more than that. Computer use has not replaced television watching. It has massively added to our screen time. a problem in itself, disembodiment, alone together. The average person receives about 30,000 commercials per year. So technology-driven consumer society was born, featuring mass production, non-stop economic growth, planned obsolescence, and techno-utopianism. We began to equate technological evolution with evolution itself. The homilies became technology brings progress, progress is good, there's no turning back. The environment still had no visible place in the story, at least not until the 1960s, when Rachel Carson wrote her great book about pesticides, and David Brower came along to rock the boat with the Sierra Club. But the downside of the story rarely got out very far. The opposition movements didn't have the money to tell the opposition story. There was still no legal process of formal disclosure of dangers of these lifestyles, no fairness doctrine, except very briefly, no assumption of guilt until proven innocent, guilty until proven innocent, no precautionary principle, no downside information at all, except for the occasional nuclear catastrophe. Mostly we stayed on the national joyride. You get to go to Walmart or Home Depot and say yes or no. That's the democratic process as far as technology is concerned. Meanwhile, the process goes on. Corporations are proceeding to convert military drones to corporate and consumer drones. Later today, we'll learn more of the big battles against the redesign of molecular structures of the planet, nanotechnology. We will hear more about geoengineering emerging, to so-called block climate change, creating new skies to offset climate change. Wouldn't we rather keep the older, bluer skies, by the way? And then there's the genetic reinvention of humans and other species, the invention of small nuclear bombs as well. That's all before we get to the total envelopment and immersion of our lives by digital and cyber tech. Is this what we want? Did anyone ever ask us? Can we please have a vote on this? I'm going to say before I close, I think I need to say a bit more about the role of advertising, if I have enough time. It's a subject we don't usually discuss at events like this, but I think we should. I'll be quick about it. I am a former advertising executive. So let me tell you that advertising imagery, which we all tend to think of as dumb and stupid, is very powerful and persuasive, especially in that kind of volume that I mentioned. We don't think about it much, but advertising is the process of projecting very powerful imagery over and over directly into your brain. Most people scoff at the notion that such images have power. We like to think our intelligence protects us, but advertising has nothing to do with intelligence. It is simpler than that. It is image implantation. Look, if I say Energizer Bunny, or Taco Bell Chihuahua, or how about Geico Gecko, did a picture of those little animals appear in your head? Did you know you were carrying them around? Can you unsee those images? My late partner in the advertising business, Howard Gossage, once said, there's a dirty little secret about advertising that nobody understands. That once the images are in your head, they never go away. They are yours forever. The image lives in your head and in your brain and really becomes you. Especially if you don't make efforts to actively study what's being said and figure out what you think about it. If it's coming at you at the rate of $200 billion per year, well, it explains a lot. The information imbalance in our society is vast and tragic. 200 billion a year, by the way. The average viewer sees 30,000 commercials every year. How do we protect ourselves from this? So, in conclusion, I'll read you a short summary list. 8 recommended attitudes about technology that I propose we should agitate for, get them codified, maybe discuss as we go over the weekend. 1, the precautionary principle. Since nearly all of what we're told about technology comes from its proponents, be deeply skeptical of all the claims. What's been left out of the story? We can no longer assume that new technology is innocent until proven guilty. The opposite should be the case. Guilty until proven innocent. That's the precautionary principle. It must be codified. 2, never judge a technology by the way it benefits you personally. Always seek a holistic view of its impacts on nature, on resources, on people, on the future. The operative question is not whether it benefits you, but who benefits most and to what ends. 3, get rid of the idea that all technology is neutral, that it can be used for good or bad. Every technology has inherent, identifiable social, political, cultural, and environmental consequences. Langdon Winter calls it autonomous technology. If society accepts automobiles, you get the roads going the way and the oil development and so on. There's no way around that. The idea that technology is neutral is itself not neutral. It ignores intrinsic dangers and puts blame solely on users. 4, make distinction between technologies. Is that 18 minutes?
Yes.
Okay, I got 2 minutes. Make distinction between technologies that primarily serve the small community, let's say local solar and small-scale farming, and those that inherently operate on a large scale, like nuclear or fossil fuels. 6, do not accept the homily that once the genie is out of the bottle, you can't put it back. All it takes is public discussion. All it takes is public discussion and empowerment. Let's start that today. 7, thinking about technology, always emphasize the negative, as I'm doing, because that's what's usually left out of discussion. This brings balance. Negativity is positive. Finally, my last point, we need to ask some direct questions about the continued viability of any economic system that has an obvious intrinsic need to drive the kind of destructive behavior we here discuss. Use of technology to drive constant growth on a finite planet motivated by self-interest and profit and immorality in the face of obvious devastation. Such a system may have been viable at a much earlier time on this planet when resources and nature were abundant, but it's now clearly obsolete. It's time to start experiencing and outlining the ingredients of something new and relevant that starts with and is bound by respect for nature, its limits, and its wildlife, as well as people. We will hopefully have a good discussion about this over the weekend. And I'll stop there. So thanks so much for your attention.
You've been listening to Jerry Mander speaking at a two-day teach-in in New York City last weekend called Techno-Utopianism and the Fate of the Earth, Why Technology Will Not Save the World. This is KWMR, 90.5 FM, Point Reyes Station, 89.9 FM Bolinas, and 92.3 FM in the San Geronimo Valley. KWMR, Community Radio for West Marin, holds monthly board meetings that are open to the public. These meetings are held on the third Wednesday of each month from 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the Point Reyes Station Public Safety Building and Firehouse, located at 4th and B Streets. For more information, call KWMR at 415-663-8068, extension 105. And now back to our teach-in. The next speaker will be Doug Tompkins. And Doug is a wilderness advocate, mountaineer, climber, organic farmer, former owner of Esprit, founder of the Foundation for Deep Ecology, Conservation Land Trust, and Conservacion Patagonica in South America. So here is Doug Tompkin.
Our next speaker is, like David Ehrenfeld, an existentially committed conservationist. Doug Tompkins is a wilderness advocate, a mountaineer, and founder of the Foundation for Deep Ecology, which has supported a tremendous amount of visionary work in exploring a different paradigm for our relation to nature. He is the founder of the Conservation Land Trust and Conservacion Patagonica, and the author of, just lately, 180 Degrees South, Conquerors of the Useless. Let's welcome Doug Tompkins.
Just to give you a little bit of atmosphere, you'll be seeing a sort of a continuous reel of photographs that are self-explanatory, you gentlemen, although they have some beginnings. And this is just to kind of put the context on a few of the remarks I'm going to make, and of course many people have been making during the course of these 2 days. And I just want you to just sort of let them go by, and maybe it'll kind of sink in that what we're seeing here is the consequence of the techno-industrial culture, that we're immersed in a system that's wrecking the world. The reason why we have conservation movement, why we have an environmental movement, and it's taking lots of forms, and it's accelerating. So just kind of let those things cruise through your mind. And as Jerry said, images, once they go in, they stay there. So I hope that will kind of help sensitize ourselves to this. We use these kind of images. Some of you may be familiar with the books that our foundation publishes. Tom Butler, who you heard a little bit earlier, speaking about the most recent book on overdevelopment, overpopulation, and overshoot, that'll be out shortly. I noticed there are a few books out on the stands out there. One of the recent ones was a book on energy that I did in cooperation with the Post Carbon Institute. They're activist books aimed at what we call, and I'll touch on it a little bit, the building of the intellectual infrastructure that's necessary to get a systemic analysis in the minds of activists, first and foremost, and then to widen that circle out to the leadership, which might, you know, even political leadership, or the press, or the professional side of society. 2 or 3% of society usually takes the rest of society with it. I call that 2 or 3% the leadership. But those are the ones that, as activists, I think we have to activate and to get it, to push the bar up on their understanding, a deep systemic analysis of the issues that are in front of us. To start out, I'd like to talk about the current, to me, one of the most potent weapons of mass destruction, the cell phone. And I propose, because I'm sure that I'm talking to literally a room of 100% socially responsible activist types, that we should take that cell phone. And I'm also assuming that the majority of you might have it, although we are in a group here which I've already talked to some people who don't have a cell phone. But in any case, whether it's yours or somebody you know in your family, friends, associates, anywhere, take that cell phone and make a little experiment. It takes a month to do it, but it takes 5 seconds every day. Ten seconds every day. And take that thing and just hold it out there in front of you and look at it and let your mind go back through all the processes that you can imagine that it took to get that cell phone in your hand, that little apparatus, that little device in your hand. And there you'll see what I think Wes Jackson invented the term. You will see the scaffolding of civilization that holds up the manufacture. Let's not even discuss the use of this thing. Manufacture of that little device. And we have the mining, we have the refining, we have the machines that do the mining, we have the machines that make the machines that do the mining, we have the transporting system, we have the houses that the machine operators live in, we have the roads that they travel on and on and on. And that is the thing that's producing what you're seeing up here on the screen. And this is a techno-industrial culture, which I don't know a better word for it than that, but it is destroying the world. So it seems logical, it seems prudent, it seems intelligent that we make a deep systemic analysis of how this got to be, and that the development trajectory, the notion of progress, is tied in to that idea of the techno-industrial direction and form of development. And so far, if we trace it back, we can get back into the epistemologies, the worldview, flowing out of the Enlightenment, the scientific revolution, and so forth. That brings us today to the so-called information revolution that's taking place and is manifested in this little small portable, highly accelerating device called the cell phone, which is a little computer to carry around. And of course, it's got other negative side effects to know about. It's produced a narcissistic society that has taken pictures of us. But leaving those kind of trivial things aside, its main function is to accelerate the transfer of living nature to that the realm of production, basically. That's what it does the best. And when it was being invented, really, as an outgrowth and a now miniaturization of the PC, the personal computer, I was living in San Francisco in those days, was friends with Steve Jobs, and we used to talk about this. And of course, here he was promoting this. This was the road to paradise. This was the utopia. And he'd get real huffy with me when I told him that it was going to do nothing but destroy the world. And he came out with this fantastic advertising campaign. You may remember it. It was splashed across every single print media you could see. And it was telling you about the thousand wonderful things that technology was going to bring. And of course, like all messiahs, these were all good things. But in our conversation sitting around at my house in San Francisco late at night, I kept getting on his case about how come all those thousand things that nobody could argue with only added up to 5% of what this magical device did. The other 95% of it was all negative. It was the conversion of nature to the realm of production, and it was accelerating this process. So this got me at that time, this is almost 30 years ago, thinking deeply about the question of technology. And I think, in my advice, for what it's worth, and of course we have a room full of people who have been thinking deeply about this, but for many of us, even close colleagues, we have to learn from each other, and we have to build this intellectual infrastructure in our heads to be able to make a real, solid, systemic analysis. And that these technologies are not neutral, but they have an inherent logic. I hope we'll hear some more from Langdon Winner, who's really developed this idea and is one of my mentors in this line of thinking, that when a society adopts any given technology, it's going to be obliged to behave according to the dictates of that technology. This is a sort of a critical, I think, linchpin in the arguments of this systemic analysis. Once we get that, we can start to put up an adequate filter about the kind of technologies that we allow into the culture. And until we get that, I don't think you can really see it. And I think once you do that, you'll start to roll the clock back, so to speak, and unroll many of these technologies, these mega technologies, because they have to have, just like that cell phone, they have to have the whole scaffolding of civilization to hold them up. And it's the scaffolding and the existence of the scaffolding that becomes the problem. And we can't escape that. It's obliging us to build a techno-industrial culture. And that techno-industrial culture, we can go through the worldview that is built on the mechanistic worldview. You already heard some of that earlier from Charlene. But we're using the wrong model. We're using the machinist model rather than nature's model. Once again, Wes is just sitting here off to my right. We'll tell you about nature as measure in much greater detail. But if we're using nature as a model or we're using the machine as the model, I find is one of the watersheds upon which we're able to reframe a worldview that could possibly, with no guarantees, give a rapprochement with nature and human societies. So I take that if we use, as I don't know exactly what Wes is going to be saying, but I've been listening to Wes for 20-some years, so I have a general idea what he'll be talking about. But I suggest that we use biodiversity as the metric, biodiversity health as the metric, the overall metric, that the replacement of the GNP or even well-being indicators to see how the human project is faring. That we use biodiversity, because if we continue the extinction crisis, the mother of all crises, to its logical conclusion, and if humanity would somehow magically survive that, we'll be sitting on a sand dune with cockroaches and a few Norwegian rats, and that'll be the end of it. I use biodiversity as the measure, and if we're not slowing down now and reversing the extinction crisis, everything else is irrelevant. Social justice is laudable as it is, important, needs to be a half step behind and on the shoulder of biodiversity conservation and the ending of the extinction crisis. Because if we can solve the extinction crisis, most all other problems will start to fall in line or be within reach of solving. It will not guarantee an equitable society. I understand that. That will have to be worked on by itself. But there will be no social justice, as they say, on a dead planet. So we have to put it half a step behind biodiversity conservation. And that's enough for a second to undermine social justice efforts. Those have to be going on simultaneously. But I think it would be good that we green the reds and the reds green the reds get the greens get redder. So an ethical stance. I think that we haven't talked too much about ethics so far, but I think that this is the thing that informs our own individual behavior. And again, if biodiversity is the metric, I think that sharing the planet with other creatures is the phrase, perhaps, that best articulates my sense of how we can find an ethical stance. And it, again, if we take that seriously, and we believe in that, and we work towards that, even immersed in a techno-industrial system that we're trying to transition out of, or we'd like to transition out of, we will have a good ethical position, and that will filter back literally into everything that we do. From an activist standpoint, another point that I think is worth making is that there's a tendency, a strong tendency, for us to jump to action, to jump to strategies. And I just caution our fellow activists to spend more time on the substantive, systemic, deep systemic analysis of the issues that we're working on. Again, that's one of the reasons for the books that we do. The last point is that hope. Every day we're getting negative and depressing news. We see it right and left, especially if we're in the activist community. This has a demotivating and an enervating impact on us. I just wanted to point out that all of you, in whatever part of the social movement you see yourself, you're in an unstoppable movement. Be it the peace movement, feminist movement, social justice movement, to conservation, environmental movement. These are unstoppable movements. If we take a look at the modern environmental movement started, say, they say, in 1962 with Rachel Carson's book, and it's just been expanding out and out and out since that time. And I don't see any signs that it's flagging, that it, of course, is responding to a bigger and bigger crisis, but it's unstoppable. Can it stop and reverse the crisis that we're in? That I don't know. I have to see. In any case, to finish up, I'd just like to read a poem that will be helpful maybe to give us some vision. And this is a poem that was written 2,700 years ago, but it seems to fit what we need to be thinking about today. Better to keep your country small, your people few, your devices simple, and even those for infrequent use. Let people measure life by the meaning of death, and not go out of their way to visit far-off places with nowhere to travel and little care for display of great ships and shining weapons become mere relics of the past. That people recover the simple life, reckoning by knotted cords, delighted in a basic meal, pleased with humble attire, happy in their homes, taking pleasure in their rustic ways. So content are they that nearby towns, so close the sound of dogs and roosters, forms one chorus, folks grown gray with age may pass away, never having strayed beyond the village.
Lovely. Next, I'm very happy to introduce my good friend John Michael Greer, who describes himself as an historian of ideas, which I think may just be a fancy way of saying he's a really smart and entertaining person. He's the author of 30 books, including The Wealth of Nature, and one which is in the pipeline right now called After Progress, which I'm very much looking forward to. Some of his already in print books are available on the table outside. He's also the author of The Arch Druid Report, which is a weekly blog that, if you haven't read it, I highly recommend you tune in to John's weekly musings. So happy to introduce John.
Thank you, Richard. Okay, the points that Dr. Husem has made are crucial to keep in mind, because, of course, he's quite correct. The quack nostrums being pushed by the techno-utopian crowd these days can't and won't fix the crisis of industrial society. It's critical to keep that in mind as we proceed. But there's a further reason that why all of the current hand-waving about techno-fix, this is a waste of time. And it's that further reason that I want to talk about now. Why don't we start with a show of hands? How many people in the audience today got here by jetpack? How about flying cars? Did you travel here that way? Did you have any trouble getting into the big glass dome they were supposed to put over New York City by now? How was your last vacation on the moon? Oh, and that electricity too cheap to meter that we were all supposed to get from safe, clean nuclear power? How is that working for you? I think you get my point. Since the Second World War, the American public has been barraged with any number of allegedly serious statements by allegedly serious thinkers about all the wonderful new technologies we were going to have that were certain to arrive in the very near future. Every generation has had its own potted techno-utopia marketed by the media like so much soap. It's educational as well as entertaining to turn the pages of old magazines, see what today was supposed to look like. If you do that, make a list of all the technological advantages that were supposed to happen by now, and then glance over the list and see how many actually did happen. What you'll find is the vast majority of those predictions never came true. Most of the ones that did pan out had massive downsides that nobody had expected. Or were economically unworkable, even if they were technically feasible. When all those pundits insisted that by the year 2000, well, of course we'd have cities on the moon and a cure for cancer and household robots who could cook for you, they were wrong. It really is that simple. They were wrong. The future they were predicting did not happen. The public and private funds that got spent getting ready for that future were wasted. And a galaxy of other options, many of which would arguably have been better in the first place, went by the board because too many people were daydreaming about jetpacks. I'd like to suggest that the same thing, exactly the same thing, will happen with the gaudy high-tech fantasies currently being retailed by the techno-utopian crowd. It doesn't matter how much enthusiastic rhetoric gets buttered across the media. It doesn't matter how many glossy pictures of nano this and cyber that get Photoshopped for your benefit. Been there, done that, and I'm still waiting for my flying car. There's a very good reason to think the vast majority of techno-utopian daydreams are never going to come true. And I'll get to that in a bit. But first of all, I want to confront the automatic reaction that pops up in most people's heads whenever you suggest there are hard limits to what technology can accomplish. A bit of history is useful here. Over the last couple of centuries, faith in organized religion has taken a beating in most of the industrial world. A great many people have had a hard time believing in the existence of God or what have you. But most of those people still have the emotional needs that belief in God once filled. So they started looking for surrogate deities, and of course they found them. Half the cultural history of the last 200 years has been the story of the rise and fall of a theme park full of ersatz deities. We had nationalism, worshipping an association, an assortment of nation-states. We had racism, worshipping an even more motley assortment of arbitrary ethnic categories, and the list goes on. But the most important pseudo-deity of all, the one that's become the focus of most people's progress, most people's faith these days, is progress. I've come to think that belief in progress is the unacknowledged, established religion of the modern industrial world. Once somebody gets labeled as progress, people by and large stop thinking. They stop asking hard questions. They just bow down and worship. One of the hard questions they don't ask is, just what makes a given change count as progress? What is it that assigns one thing the coveted titles of progressive, advanced, the wave of the future, and labels something else regressive, backwards, primitive? Social, cultural, technological changes don't come with those labels pre-printed on them. How do they get assigned? There are two answers to that question, and both of them have something to teach. The first is very straightforward. What determines that thing A is progressive and thing B is not is politics. There are always projects vying for funding. There are always power holders who are looking for gimmicks to secure influence and wealth for themselves. The result is that this project gets defined as the next step in a glorious onward march of progress, and that one doesn't, purely because somebody's interests are advanced by the first and not by the second. I'm old enough, for example, to remember when supersonic transports were the way of the future. Then their backers got outmaneuvered in the ongoing scrimmage of government feed trough. The public refused to support the technology, and oops, they weren't the way of the future after all. Roll out the next future. If this suggests to you that there's something distinctly arbitrary about what gets enshrined as progress, well, yes, that's what it suggests to me also. Let's stop here and notice what this implies about the old saw, you can't stop progress. If supersonic transports were progress, certainly that's what the backers said at the time, why, yes, you can't stop progress. That's why we don't have to put up with the environmental impacts of supersonic transports just now. Since the word progress is nothing more than a label for whatever happens to get funding, When somebody says, you can't stop progress, what they're actually saying is, don't you dare stop progress because my interests are at stake. So, progress is political. But there's another side to the question. You can trace it right there in the basic meaning of the word. What does progress mean when it's not applied to technology or society? When it's stripped of its pseudo-divine drag, and stands there blushing in etymological nakedness. It means continued movement in the same direction. Progress means going further in the direction you're already going. It means doing what you've always done. These days, increasingly, it means doing the same thing you've always done, but expecting a different result, which, as many of you doubtless know, is a good working definition of insanity. There's a reason, in other words, why much of what gets proclaimed as progress these days actually and inevitably makes things worse. It's called the law of diminishing returns. What that law says, basically, is that as you proceed with any activity, the relationship between costs and benefits does not remain the same as it was when you started. Sooner or later, you pass the point of diminishing returns, and your benefit for a unit cost starts to decrease. After that, you pass the point of zero marginal return, and additional benefits don't add anything. Additional expenditures don't add anything to the benefit you get. And after that, additional expenditure yields a negative marginal return. That's what was called a loss in plain English. In simpler terms, first you spend more and get less, then you spend more and get nothing. And finally, you spend more and lose. If you watch the progress of technology in recent decades, this may seem very familiar. Now, the law of diminishing returns is a principle with extraordinarily wide application. It applies to scientific research. It applies to drilling for oil. It applies to knocking back beers. I promise you, the 15th beer is not going to do you as much good as the ones that came before it. And anything else you care to name. But the heart and soul of our modern faith in progress is that it doesn't apply to progress. To believers in progress, if a little is good, a lot is better, and too much is best of all. If technology causes problems, why then the solution is more technology? And if that causes bigger problems, hey, we need more technology still. Whatever the question, technology is the only answer they're willing to think about. Now, most of us found out at some point in our adolescence that there is, in fact, such a thing as drinking too much beer. Most of us have noticed that the same principle applies to pretty much everything else, too. Our cultural biases insist that it cannot apply to progress, but I think it's time to say stop right there. Let's actually look at the costs and benefits. And let's be very clear what we mean here. By progress, I don't mean some vague sense of betterment, variables not defined. I mean doing more of what we've been doing in the last 300 years, that is to say, turning everything into an excuse to build more machines. As I think we've all started to notice, that's not working too well. From anthropogenic climate change to peak oil to the rest of the long list of troubles we're facing, all of them are either caused or worsened by technology, by the consequences of what the conventional wisdom called progress. Anthropogenic climate change, that comes out of our tailpipes and smokestacks. Peak oil would be zero problem if our technical structure didn't depend on it, and so on down the list. As Theodore Roosevelt pointed out a good long time ago, we haven't gotten to the brink of planetary catastrophe by accident. Nobody dragged us here. We've progressed here. And all we need now is one more round of progress to shove us over the edge like lemmings in a Disney nature film. Thus, I'd like to suggest that technological progress, doing more of what we've been doing for the last 300 years, has passed the point of negative returns. On the average, that is, every new technology we deploy, every further step in these so-called march of progress, costs more, accomplishes less, and causes more problems than it solves. So we don't need more technology, we need less technology. That doesn't mean no technology at all. It's a standard red herring just to say, well, if you don't want to deal with this latest snazzy thing, you want everyone to go back to the caves. We've all heard that, right? Is this nonsense? Yes, Socrates, this is nonsense. We're talking about asking the hard questions about technology that the conventional wisdom refuses to ask. We need technologies, but we need wiser technologies that recognize the limits of a fragile planet. Technologies that progress in the opposite direction from today's techno-utopian fantasies. One thing I'd point out about these wiser technologies is they're within reach. They are, by and large, simpler than our existing technologies. They're much more efficient in their use of energy and resources. A great many of them already exist. In fact, people have been working on them since the 19th century, though most people have not been taught about that. They don't require unspecified scientific breakthroughs. What they require is the willingness to recognize that, as Einstein said, we can't solve a problem by the same thinking that got us into it. And by the way, we can't maintain the lifestyles that depend on making the problem worse. Now, there's one other thing that is required here, which is the willingness to recognize just how empty the promises are the techno-utopians are making. I mean, you've already heard various discussion of various techno-utopian claims. You'll hear a lot more in the rest of this weekend. All of those claims presuppose that the law of diminishing returns doesn't apply to whatever technology we have in mind here. That we can expect all the breakthroughs we want just because we happen to want them. And I'd like to suggest that there's an agenda behind those frankly improbable claims. Like the jetpacks and the flying cars, they offer pretty daydreams of better living through technology to distract people who might otherwise make a different world for themselves. Look at what's actually happened over the decades where we're supposed to be getting those jetpacks in dome cities. What actually happened is that the standard of living for the vast majority of Americans has dropped like a rock. When I was a boy, an American family on one working class income could, by and large, afford to buy a home and a car and pay all their bills. Nowadays, an American family on one working class income is probably living on the street. The future we got wasn't the future we were promised. And this latest round of plastic tomorrow land is more of the same. Another round of nano bread and cyber circuses to keep the rabble quiet. It's working, too. Look at us. We're spending most of this weekend talking about their agenda, not about ours. So thank you. So they've already taken the first round. But behind the glossy photoshopped images of a future that's never going to arrive, it's just more of the same. More impoverishment, more environmental degradation, more broken promises to put on the shelf alongside the jetpack future we never got. We can do better than that. Frankly, we have to do better than that. And one of the first steps to doing that, it seems to me, is to recognize that there's nothing inevitable about the techno-utopian agenda. Quite the contrary, if you've learned anything from the last 7 decades, it's that grandiose technological fantasies proclaimed as the inevitable wave of the future generally end up in history's dumpster. We can expect the nanotechnology, the biotechnology, all the stuff that's being babbled about now, and don't even get me talking about the singularity. All of it, into the dumpster right next to the jetpacks. It's important to critique the current route of fantasies, but it's even more important to remember that we can take another route. We can progress in a different direction, each of us, and all of us, toward the simpler, wiser, more sustainable technologies we need to help us reach a future worth having. Thank you.